Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Memcast. My name's Tom. I'm going to be interviewing our expert for this episode. And this episode is on pacing. So we're going to talk about a few things. We're going to talk about indications for pacing. Then we're going to talk about a little bit how to manage bradycardia in a sort of acute setting. Talk about different types of pacing, complications you can get from having a pacemaker inserted. And if we have a bit of time at the end, we'll probably cover a bit of follow-up for paced patients. So without further ado, we can crack on. I'll introduce our cardiology registrar of the day, Dr. Mrinal Thacker from Peterborough City Hospital. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you for having me on the podcast, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Always, of course. Very, very, very glad that you've come on to be here for my inaugural recording. So, I mean, first thing to talk about, as I've said, is indications for pacing, of which there are numerous. Tell me a little bit about the general indications, things you might, or reasons you might want to pace a patient.
So today we'll mostly talk about bradycardia pacing, because there's also cardiac resynchronization therapies, which I guess is a topic in itself. But essentially bradycardia, when someone's got a reason for the heart to beat slowly or not fast enough to adequately perfuse their bodies. Now that could be due to primary cardiac conduction disease, or it can be due to another situation where, for whatever reason, the electrical system isn't working. And then you consider things like, you know, either a permanent pacemaker implantation or a temporary pacemaker, or if it's a really acute situation, then sometimes things like temporary wire or even percussion pacing. There's a really good guidance from European Society of Cardiologists that really summarizes all the indications for pacing, but essentially it's sinus node disease or high-grade AV block, or really bradycardia in another context that's inadequate for the body's needs.
Okay, so to ask a little bit about heart block, obviously for sort of complete heart block, you're going to be pacing almost regardless. Some of the sort of, I guess, more middle heart, you've got like type 2 and first degree heart blocks. When are you pacing those patients? Is it all the time or just all the time?
So it's a very good question. So I think, I guess, you want to think about what the risk is. So with complete heart block, the risk of going into asystole is high. You know, heart, as you know, it's got two upper chambers, two bottom chambers. The atrial tissues, in particular the sinus node, is very good at pace setting. And it can pace set for 100 years or, you know, near enough, no issues. Whereas the ventricles are very good at following commands. And they will pacemake if absolutely need to, but not for very long. So therefore, they can chug along at 40 beats per minute, but really your risk of asystole over a period of months to years is quite high, and therefore the risk of death is high. So complete heart blocks, you pace higher degree, second degree AV blocks, such as 2:1 or above, higher risk of asystole, therefore you pace. Lower, so if you've got Wenker back, that doesn't necessarily carry a higher degree of progression to asystole. Okay. And in fact, in younger patients, it may even be normal for them to have nocturnal Wenker back, or even actually isorhythmic atrial ventricular dissociation, but these are niche cases. So I would say first degree heart block and Wenker back are relatively sort of closer to the atria. Therefore, think about pacing a bit more carefully. There's, again, very good guidance, especially in younger people, because you don't want to give them a pacemaker then have to redo it roughly every 10 years and the risk of infections and everything that comes with that. But higher degree, such as type 2:1 or complete heart block, sure, go for a bradycardia pacemaker in someone with normal ejection fraction and a narrow QRS.
Perfect. And if we do get time, I know you mentioned CRT, we may be able to go over that a little bit later as well, just to talk a bit more about why you might pace in that situation. What we can talk about now is a little bit about managing bradycardia on call. So like when you're the med reg and somebody comes in and you see a lovely heart rate in the 30s or 20s, rather than madly panicking, what should we be doing?
Okay. If someone comes in and you've got, or you know, you've been called to see a patient and their heart rate's 28, so first thing to look at is endobedogram. How do they look? Are they okay? Are they dizzy? Are they sweaty? You know, are they? Is their autonomic system in overdrive because the heart isn't perfusing the tissues? If the blood pressure is low, or if they're feeling dizzy, or, you know, any of the signs of hyperperfusion, then that's officially profound bradycardia. And you should take steps to reverse that bradycardia so the heart can perfuse. ALS says triatriprine, which I try, and most of the times it works, sometimes it doesn't work. It's a short-lived medication, but at least it gives you an indication that maybe it does work. If you want a slightly longer-acting chemical pacing, then you can try isoprenaline. Now, it's not in the BNF, so you have to know the prescription, and different units have different prescriptions. But you can start them on an isoprenaline infusion. It is proarrhythmic, so you know you have to think about if they've had a proven history of other arrhythmias, especially ventricular arrhythmias, you want to be careful with that. Mm. But it's something that we use fairly regularly, and it's relatively successful. So that's really, and then you get down to sort of your rhythms, and you know, if you don't have atropine available, or if your atropine doesn't work, or if your cannula tissues, then you've got other means such as transcutaneous pacing or percussion pacing, or temporary wires.
Okay. You've talked a little bit about the steps you go through when you see these patients. First thing, atropine to try and bring it up in the short term, isoprenaline in the long term, and then you've mentioned sort of transcutaneous pacing and temporary wires. Is that sort of in a situation where you find you can't give the medical therapy, for example, they have isoprenaline and maybe it triggers an arrhythmia and you're worried about that?
Yeah, or sometimes I've been in situations where isoprenaline isn't available because they've run out, or, you know, whatever logistical reason they don't have it, or you know they don't have a cannula and it's, you know, or they're bradycardic and they've seized and you know you need to sort the bradycardia there. So you could try transcutaneous pacing. So some defibrillators, not all defibrillators in most trusts, have pacing modes on. So it's always worth checking whenever you get the crash trolley whether your defibrillator has a pacing module on. If it does, essentially what you do is you stick the pads on, switch the defibrillator onto the pacer mode, you turn the current up, and I normally stick the rate to 100 and then turn it down depending on how you get capture. It is painful, so you should consider sedation and analgesia for the patient. Mm. When you get capture, you will see pacing spikes. And then if you see a QRS immediately after that, you know you're getting capture. And then you turn the current down to the lowest current possible, so you're getting capture. And I normally leave it about 40 to 50 beats per minute if the patient is okay with that, because the myocardium it's used to being paced. So if you're pacing from the outside and if you set it to 70 beats a minute, it will get used to that very quickly in seconds. Mm. So you don't want to make the myocardium overtly dependent on external pacing, because when you do come to do permanent pacing, you're going to have periods where you're going to have to sort of put a lead in, and that might take, you know, 30 seconds. And you want to make sure that the myocardium isn't too dependent. It's not the be all and end all, but it's just something to think about.
So in general, it's better to have it as low a rate as possible to achieve the perfusion that you need.
Yeah, you want to promote intrinsic rhythm. And that's a general principle for all bradycardia, right ventricular pacing. You want to promote the intrinsic rhythm.
And I guess a question that I wanted to ask for anyone that's on call, if you've got someone that's bradycardic and you've done the initial management, when should they be worried enough to call the cardiologist on call if they have one?
Yeah, okay. So if, for example, you can't transcutaneously pace for some reason, if you're having side effects from isoprenaline or, you know, other chemical pacing agent, if they're having tachycardia and bradycardia at the same time, you know, you give them isoprenaline, they suddenly go into an arrhythmia, you stop it, they're bradycardic, then you might want to think about putting a temporary wire in. If they've got long QT and they're going into polymorphic VT because their normal underlying rhythm is too slow, in which case you want to overdrive pace them slightly faster to make sure the R on T phenomenon doesn't happen, for example. Situations like these, which are uncommon, but do happen.
Then give you a call.
Yeah, then I'd be calling for a temporary pacing wire.
Right.
Really, if someone needs a pacemaker, if someone's got complete heart block, they need a permanent system. And it's much better to make one incision and install one system rather than two different incisions and two systems. If you can tie them over into the morning when it can be done safely, that's preferable.
So we can get to the sort of bulk of everything now, which is to talk about the types of pacing. Obviously, we've talked a little bit about, you know, transcutaneous pacing and temp wires, which I guess technically are types of pacing. Mm. But you mentioned what you would rather do is have people stick around till the morning, and then you can put in a proper pacemaker. Mm. So there's a lot to talk about with pacemakers. We've talked about why you're going to put them in. I think one of the good places to start, because then it leads us to talking about what pacemakers are good in what situation, is sort of what pacemaker codes mean and what kind of settings you can have for a pacemaker.
Yeah. Yes, sure, we could talk about it. There's just one more thing I'd like to mention about the types of pacing is percussion pacing. Mm-hmm. And now this is something that is quite useful, especially, say, for example, if you're transferring a patient and you're in a lift and due to some sort of technical failure, you can't pace them. So you can essentially drop your fist on someone's precordium and that will sometimes pace them, in summary.
Sounds quite heroic and dramatic. Have you ever had to do it?
Once.
In a lift?
Not in a lift, but it did work, yeah. And I've known other people who've done it, and it does tend to work, so that's definitely something to think about. But going back to your question, the pacing modes. So a dual chamber pacemaker, which is one lead in the atrium and one lead in the right ventricle, usually the right ventricular apex. You can program it in certain ways. Now, there's an internationally accepted code. It's got 4, sometimes 5 letters. And those 5 letters mean something. So the first letter is usually D or A or V. So dual, atrial, or ventricular. It means the chamber that is paced. The second letter means the chamber that is sensed. The third letter means whether it inhibits or does other functions. And the fourth letter is sort of another qualifier code. And there's also a fifth letter, usually R, which means whether it's rate responsive or not. As you can imagine, the combinations and permutations of these letters is huge and beyond the scope of this podcast. But in summary, if someone's got atrioventricular disease and then sinus rhythm, you want to promote the intrinsic conduction. So you want to pace the atria really the minimum required time so they conduct through their natural system, and you only pace the ventricle as a backup, because pacing the ventricles from the RV is intrinsically not physiological. And over time there's evidence that it promotes heart failure, so you want to minimize that and really absolutely do it if you absolutely have to. So for example, if someone's got AV node disease, you want to set them in a mode where they sense the atria, and then after a while, after let's say 150 millisecond pause, which is a normal PR interval, I guess, you sense the ventricle, and if it's conducted, if the ventricles have activated, it won't pace. But if it hasn't conducted, or if the ventricles haven't activated, you might want to give them maybe another 30, 40 milliseconds. And then if there's still no ventricular activity, it will pace. But if someone's got atrial fibrillation and they've got permanent atrial fibrillation and they've been in atrial fibrillation for donkey's years, there's no point putting an A lead in, because you're never going to get the capture. And you're only going to sense AF, which you know is there anyway. And you just want to pace the ventricle. So you would just set that as a VVI. So V pace, sense the ventricle. Inhibit, so if it senses that the ventricle has activated, it won't pace. And the fourth letter is 0, because there's only one lead, so it doesn't apply to the two leads. And R, sometimes, depending on what the situation is.
So that's actually clarified something for me. When it's talking about inhibit, it's not talking about what the pacemaker does to the heart, it's talking about what essentially the heart's doing to the pacemaker.
Yeah.
So if the heart beats, it will inhibit the pacemaker.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay.
Yeah. And then there's nuances to that, but sure.
As a general rule.
Yeah.
And you mentioned obviously that would be VVI for, say, AF with heart block. So you put that in. You'd use DDD for?
DDD would mean dual chamber pacing. So it can pace both ventricle and atrium. Dual sensing. So it senses both the atrium and the ventricle. And DR, so that would mean it can also inhibit or increase, or whatever the other code is that I can't remember, depending on what the situation is. So in someone like sinus node disease, for example, who is a cyclist, the way the rate response works in some devices is it's got accelerometers in it. So if you're a cyclist, you are not going to be moving that much, and you're not going to be sensing movement. So it's not going to know that you're actually exerting yourself quite fast. So it's going to be sensing the atria. It's going to be sensing the ventricles. And then it's just going to try and pace at a base rate. But obviously, you're going to need more heart rate. So I think there's some other fancy algorithms that it can use to turn on to ensure that they're still having the...
So it paces you faster when you're exerting yourself because it can work
that
out.
Yeah. But there's various algorithms.
Very interesting, though.
Very interesting. And, you know, it's only based... It can only see from the two leads. It doesn't know anything else. And sometimes the atrial lead can sense ventricle leads. So they have refractory periods where they blanked. You cannot sense anything. And the combination of these sensing and pacing means you can sometimes cause inadvertent tachycardia because the pacemaker thinks you're going too slow and you need to be paced faster. It's very interesting.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay. So predominantly, those are the codes that we're going to come across in patients that have been paced because they are bradycardic. Mm. Might, a bit of time, just very quickly talk about CRT, yep. which doesn't fit into any of those codes necessarily.
No.
But so we see on call.
Yes. So CRT is cardiac resynchronization therapy. Mm. So this is three leads. So one in the atrium, right atrium, one in the right ventricle, and one in the coronary sinus to pace the left ventricle. So if you've got heart failure and if you've got left bundle branch block, so your outer, the lateral wall, the way the LV contracts is the lateral wall comes in later compared to the septum, whereas the RV, the contraction actually starts from the septum. And it's more of a sort of peristalsis-y type movement rather than a contraction and a squeeze. Mm. So if you've got heart failure and you've got a broad QRS, that means you've got ventricular desynchrony. So the right and the left are beating at slightly different times and therefore there's hemodynamic compromise. So if you could narrow the QRS down, make the ventricles beat slightly more in time, you improve the hemodynamics. And that's the principle. So you try and time the pacing. So the right ventricle lead paces X milliseconds after the coronary sinus lead. So you'd narrow the QRS and you improve the ventricular function that way. Mm-hmm. Indications for those are usually in patients with heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction who have been on optimal medical therapy and are still significantly symptomatic, that is class 3-ish or above, despite that, in which case you might consider a device. And now they have another code after that, which is P or D, so CRTP or CRTD. CRTP is a pacemaker only, and CRTD is a CRT with a defibrillator built in. Now, again, that's another sort of topic in itself about who gets a defibrillator and who gets a pacemaker and whether that's, you know, what's beneficial and what isn't, because defibrillator isn't benign therapy and it can actually cause harm. There's evidence to suggest that actually medical therapy is so good now in some patients that you don't need a defibrillator.
No, but it's interesting to hear about those decisions aren't clear cut. It's not like you're just putting a defib lead in everybody, because why wouldn't you? There are actually things to think about.
Oh yes.
Yeah. And if people have a CRT, does that improve their ejection fraction? Does that improve their symptoms?
It can do. Oh. Yeah, it definitely improves the symptoms. And it's something that, you know, say for example, if someone's got renal failure and you can't give them, you know, some medications. I've seen patients like that get CRT and it improves the quality of life.
Perfect. We can talk a little bit, given that we've talked about the devices, about things we need to look out for in patients that have just had devices put in. So, you know, if you're on the take, somebody comes in having recently had a pacemaker, or even on the ward, someone that's just had a pacemaker put in, what kind of complications can we expect?
Yeah, so I think it's best to think about this in sort of chronic and acute. You know, you've got your acute complications, such as damage to the vascular structures inside, pneumothorax, and pericardial effusion or tamponade. These are emergencies, and you know, hypoxic chest pain, hypertension, and the treatment is, you know, if they've got a pneumothorax, then you follow the BTS guidance, put in a chest drain if you need to. Pericardial effusion, a tamponade is a clinical diagnosis. If they are in tamponade and you've got clinical evidence and you've got the expertise, then you put a drain in to get to relieve the pressure. I guess those are the main acute complications. Subacute / chronic complications include things like infections, pacemaker associated infections, sometimes rarely endocarditis. You can get wound site infections. You have to take those quite seriously. If there's any evidence of sort of infection of the hardware, then you should discuss them with the cardiology team because I think the threshold for treating those aggressively is quite low.
Mm.
The other longer term complication is if you've only got a bradycardia pacing from the right ventricle apex, your risk of heart failure goes up, especially if you're pacing a lot of the time. And I guess the other important thing to mention is pacemaker-mediated tachycardias, which goes down to the algorithms and the sensing and whether your leads move, leads displace, displacement, I guess, although it's not that common. But there's something called twiddler syndrome, worth looking up, which is patients who like to twiddle with the pacemakers and essentially pull the leads out before they've had a chance to set in. Has been known to happen, but it doesn't happen that commonly. But those are just some of the main things. I don't think I've missed any major ones out.
Absolutely not. We said if we got time, we might talk a little bit about, is there much specific follow-up for a patient once they've had a pacemaker put in? Is there anything really you think is worth that people should know about the follow-up or not so much?
Usually they get followed up in the pacing clinic where a physiologist would check the pacemaker settings, check whether they're measurements, you know, whether the voltage required to pace has gone up or not, whether the impedance has changed, you know, what the wound is looking like, how the symptoms doing. And most of the times it's okay. They don't need any specific sort of cardiologist follow-up or even a general medical follow-up. But depending on the indication, you might want to see them again because you might need to titrate the antiarrhythmic therapy. For example, if someone's got tachybrady syndrome, and you know, you put a pacemaker in to stop the heart from going too slow, it doesn't slow the heart down. So you need to give them medication and they may well need more medication.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your whistle stop tour of pacing. It's very, very interesting.
Thank you for having me.
Were there anything you want people to hang on to particularly from what you've said, like any real sort of take home messages?
Yeah, first thing is pacing, such as transcutaneous pacing or percussion pacing or atropine or isoprenaline, can be life saving. And I think with atropine, the risk of harm is relatively low. So I think if you've got a patient that you think would benefit from atropine, I think you know, it's a time critical thing, and you know, follow the ALS guidance and treat them. Equally, there are certain situations where you benefit from certain more advanced things, just temporary-wise, so don't be afraid to call the cardiology team at night. The final thing is CRTs are becoming more and more common, and they do improve quality of life and quantity of life for heart failure patients. So I think another podcast at some point talking about them would be good.
Yeah. I know you've reminded me just to mention as well, obviously with CRTs, like you said, most pacemakers, you want to have their intrinsic rhythm, but CRTs, if you see that on an ECG, they should be pacing all the time.
Yes. So if essentially anything less than 100% biventricular pacing percentage time, you have to think about why they're not using the CRT all of the time. It's usually some sort of arrhythmia or a lead issue or something else. But you know, if the CRT, if you've got a CRT and you only biventricular pacing 94% of the time, that isn't really good enough. You should be 100%. Upwards. Yeah. You know, ideally 100%, yeah.
Perfect. Thanks very much again. We'll get you back for the CRT one then, clearly.
Oh, can't wait.
Absolutely. I guess all that remains is to say, make sure you're looking on the Instagram and the Twitter for the MRCP questions, and make sure you're listening next week for the next episode as well. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.